We are back from our weather related hiatus. Thank you all for coming out tonight. We are so excited to be here for Robert Owen Robin.
Before we get started, we do have a couple of reminders. Please feel free to get a drink at the bar, use the restroom, and watch the animations at all, but please do be respectful of our reader and do that as quietly as possible. Also, please silence your cell phones and beepers, etc. And please join me in welcoming the person that's going to introduce our reader tonight, Dr. David Kirby.
Thank you. May I point out that the person over here by a big stack of books is not here for her health. Ladies and gentlemen, Midtown Readers is one of my biggest supporters. Please go over there and buy those books. And by the way, I don't know if you tried to come down here last week. I thought about it, but I figured, nah. Yolanda was supposed to read Black Franklin, and we're rescheduling this. So we're going to get your full dose of vitamin Y, guaranteed, will help. So anyway, it's almost as though it didn't happen. I mean, here we missed 1 week, but here we are, and all this stuff to do, yard work, and throw out the melted ice cream, and all this kind of stuff. You know, the big thing around school is that we have to reschedule tests, right? You know, everybody's supposed to take a test on Wednesday and Thursday, we have to reschedule it. It made me think of one of my favorite Catholic saints, Joseph of Cupertino. Any of you lapsed Catholics know about Joseph? Well, in case you're the right guy, because Joseph was born on June 17, 1603 in Naples, and he was kind of a dolt. He was known as a gaper in school because he was standing around with his mouth open. And he didn't forget to eat. People would say, Joseph, did you have breakfast or lunch or dinner this week? And he would say, no, I forgot. So you kind of see where he's heading towards that holy man status. And he wanted to be a Franciscan friar. He was too much of a dolt to be one, because my Franciscans are pretty sharp. So he hung around here, and he liked him so much, he said, okay, well, let you take the entrance exam. The entrance exam consists of the bishop coming around and opening the Bible, putting his finger on the verse, and say, okay, I'm looking at such and such a verse, quote it back to the Bible, and then explain it. Of the whole Bible, which you know is a big Manhattan yellow pages, which is comparing one big book to another, but you get the idea. But anyway, so the bishop comes around. St. Joseph knew, he wasn't saint yet, but he knew only one verse, which is Luke 11, line 27. And the bishop said, okay, buddy, let's go and put it up. The verse in question here is Luke 11, line 27. So he said, I know that one. And he got it. So he got right in. Not only was he But the bishop was so knocked back that he said, gosh, if all of the bishops are smart as you are, everybody can join in the priesthood and just welcome a class of about 20 of the people. And so the reason why I'm telling you about Joseph, you might not have been in it last week, but might be in the future, because he is the patron saint of test takers. He's also described as the patron saint of weak students instead of the Catholic websites like Robert Owen Butler. St. Joseph also had another skill, which he could fly, he could levitate, he would get these ecstasies on it, and he would be getting whoop, whoop, just go way up like that, which was, you'd like to be able to do that, but his superiors did not, because it was associated with the occult, witchcraft, things like that. So that they would say, Joe, bring it down. And they would keep him in there, send him back to the stables, and he would donkeys and things like that. But every once in a while, there was a procession, and he would get out and join it. The music would start up again. Somebody help me! And he would just be up like 20 feet above the clouds like that. So he's also the patron saint of pilots. That brings me around to Bob, is because can't help myself. The Catholic Church does like to hedge its bets. So some of the websites I looked at said, at the very end, they would say, St. Joseph of Cupertino was also very well known for his ordinary activities. We would all be saints if it was just that, but if you have ordinary activities and are a magical test taker, you can fly. Your fate is assured. But there's nothing ordinary, my dear friends, about Bob Butler. Bob began to sniff around Florida State. We began to sniff around Bob Butler, I think, could it have been 18 years ago? Was it that 18 years ago? And I'd read a lot about Bob, and I'd read everything that he'd written. And I said, I really kind of like this guy, so I thought I'd put out a little extra effort. So Barbara and I had him over, and we cooked up a bunch of barbecue and all the good stuff that goes with it. Invited a bunch of people. And so anyway, among those who were there, Professor Mark Weingartner, Professor Virgil Suarez, and lots of other people. But the third person I'm thinking of, his name is lost to history, but it was a graduate student of the Suarezian or Weingartnerian stature. I see some scowls out there. Maybe you don't know who these people. They're big men. You know, I mean, they're solid. There's all muscle. But I mean, you know, we're talking about the linebacker kind of range of them. These people were not. They were not Zach Lynchies. In fact, Zach would have been 3 years old at that time, if he's 21 years old today. But anyway, we have picnic tables set up on the deck, and you know, people were sitting around the other side of it. And these three good-sized fellows got up and went and got more barbecue, which meant that each added about 5 pounds to his already considerable stature, right? So they came back, and Bob was sitting by himself on the other side of the table. Now, remember when you were a little kid? A big kid had been on the seesaw, and the little kid was on the other end of the seesaw. Well, these three guys all sat down as though they had orchestrated it at once. And kafoom, Robert Owen Butler flies into the air. And my first thought was, St. Joseph of Cupertino. Actually, that was my second thought. My first thought was this. You know, if you kill a job candidate, the newspaper the next day will say, job candidate dies tragic death. But if you kill a Pulitzer Prize winner, the headlines the next day will say, Kirby kills Pulitzer Prize winner. So I ran over to where Bob was among the azaleas, scooped him up, took him in my arms, and said, Bob. He looked up at me and said, I want you to meet my colleague. And he said, what's your name? And I said, David Kirby. And Bob took my face in his hands and he said, I want to be your colleague too, David. And so it's been that way ever since. Bob is the author of 16 novels, some of which are for sale over here, but 17 novels, and not long from now, 18 novels, and... Four collections of short stories? Six collections of short stories. Man, he brings them out faster than the data can change. In addition to a Pulitzer Prize in 1993 and two National Magazine Awards, he received a Guggenheim Fellowship, an NEA grant. He published a volume of his lectures on the creative process called From Where You Dream, which is edited with an introduction by Janet Burnway. He recently gave bags and bags and boxes of tons of books to the Binding Key book and manuscript library here. His latest book, and I think I see a lot of copies over there, is Paris in the Dark, and no less a critic than Marilyn Stasio of the New York Times Book Review said, best is Butler's feel for the black and white movie atmospherics of a war zone after hours. It's a thrill to follow Kit Marlowe to German hangouts like the Rouge et Noir, where a password will get you in, but there's no guarantee that you'll get out. And so, here he is, the author of many books, a dedicated worker, the lucky husband of Kellyanne Butler. He flies through the air with the greatest of ease, ladies and gentlemen, Robert Owen Bob Butler.
Thank you, David. I remember the alien incidents as if it was yesterday. Not
forth for, you know, my pedagogy for Martyr Stone, you know, adult who can fly. That's, understand the subtext of your question. All right. This is the world premiere of this. I'm going to read to you virtually every word I have now written in my new novel. And it is so new that the last 1,500 words or so I did my Airbnb in London this past week. And even Kelly has not heard of it. So at this point, I would love to just share this with you and listen to myself and see if I'm going all right. I think the novel is going to be called Who. Who. Not what. Who. All right. There's a copy desk in my brain with a gooseneck lamp and a pot of rubber cement and a coffee mug full of Dixon pencils. Let's edit this at once. Not precisely my brain. I am separated even from that, it seems. Ironically so, as I feel a clarity inside me now that I haven't felt for a long time. The copy chief is at the desk as well, hunched there, composing a headline for the story that now is unfolding, not in my brain, but somewhere else. He hands it to me. Triple death. Muckhead wins. Editor-in-chief begins to die. I've been watching. For years, I've been watching the television screen floating near the ceiling beyond the foot of my bed. Tonight, they thought I was asleep for good. While accompanied by a solitary figure in the darkened room, sitting on a chair at my bedside, the screen lit before both of us. Where I lay, the time was 1:45 in the morning of November 9th, 2016. But at this moment, I am somewhere else. My copy desk editor is having his little joke. Ezra Mandel from the Chicago Gazette. Dead long ago, I know. Both man and newspaper. But somehow I am not surprised that this Ezra, who has turned his mare gray eyes and his ocean wave mustache toward me, the latter masking beneath its surface what I take to be a sly smile. I look at the first sentence of the story. 10 minutes after Donald J. Trump was declared President of the United States, the last living veteran of World War I began to die in a nursing home in New Orleans, Louisiana. This I take to be true. The event on the television and the last living veteran of the Great War in his nursing home, certainly. That's me, or so I've been told, the last one. That's where I am. And that's what the United States of America has suddenly become. I have to believe the news hook as well. It's high time it began to die. And another thing I believe is that I am about to hear the voice of God. I believe it with an instinctive assurance that is no doubt straight from him. Samuel, he says, in a mellifluous tenor voice. For a moment, I try to convince myself it's Ezra, but it clearly is not. Ezra has vanished. The voice has come from the dark. But God apparently has taken Ezra's chair at the copy desk. He edits that last thought of mine from the dark matter, he says. This recent scoop about infinitesimal stuff teeming in the void has been lingering in the news and in my mind. I say to God, does all that have something to do with you? I have no comment, he says. I have no newspaper, I say. He humps gently. I am the interviewer for now, he says. I want you to talk to me, Samuel, on the record. Can I ask another question first, off the record? Yes, you can. What the hell just happened? You have begun to die, he says. I don't mean that, I say. Oh, you mean him, God says. You tell me. Tell you what, I have no idea. Neither do I, he says. That's how I chose to make you humans, full of surprises. I feel a sudden draft from the dark, a sigh, I presume. And then he says, so tell me, Sam, what was your life all about? This gives me pause. I've been expecting to die for quite a while. Since I turned 100, certainly. I was pushing 116 until a couple of minutes ago, which had for some time been daily surprising the hell out of me. But I haven't been particularly religious for many decades, maybe ever, really. So at no time have I been expecting a judgment day, if that's what this is. May I ask one more question? Yes, this time the sigh is in his tone. I pause ever so slightly. Yes, I'm omniscient, he says, which indeed is the answer to my most current question, the one that arose in me in that pause as soon as I asked a question about asking a question. He says, now you can ask the previous one, the important one. Do I need to speak it? Yes, you need to speak it. Not that it's strictly necessary, but it's part of the process. Trust me. I feel the urge to chuckle. Go ahead and let it out, he says. I'll share the irony with you. I chuckle. In God we trust. Now the man himself feels he has to solicit my trust so I can tell him my American story. The man himself. Man. Another digressive question comes to mind. I'm gender fluid, he answers. With me being a guy born in 1901, this was another newsbreak of a concept lately floating from the screen at the end of my bed. Look, God says, don't concern yourself with pronouns. Think of me the way you need to think of me. Now ask your real question so we can get on with this. All right, I said, are there consequences to the telling of your life? No. I wait for more. Nothing is forthcoming. No consequences to the telling. How about the life itself? He reads my mind. Ambiguous, he says. Yes, I admit it. But you find I've always been ambiguous with humanity. You surprise me, I surprise you. It's your surprises I'm worried about, he said. I want you to tell me your own story as it comes to you, like brainstorming. God pauses. He edits himself. No, that will lead you astray. Think of it as dreamstorming. That sounds like what I used to do as a young crime reporter in Chicago, out by the lake or in a tenement or on a back path in Grant Park, at the crime scene, before figuring out the lead and putting it all in logical sequence for the Bulldog edition. I'd fill my notebooks with the blood stains, or the weeping in the corner, or the oblivious wind in the trees, the stuff that felt like how it all really was, like the story I was going to write was true enough, but artificial somehow. You were a good newsman, God says. Just give it to me straight from your notebook. I thrill at the compliment, but I know it isn't enough to get me into heaven. I look down at my hands. I suppose I'm looking for the notebook. God says, you start taking me literally, we're not going to get anywhere together. I look in the direction of the voice. It's still dark out there. Right, I say. I'm not supposed to see your face either. See your earthly father, he says. Start with him. And I try. I find a time gone by, a century gone. But I'm not looking at Papa's face, though I'm walking right beside him, sure enough. We've just stepped out of the general store and turned north on the wood-planked sidewalk that runs along our main street parallel to the river. He has made it a point to take me for what he calls a sweets run, him being under instructions from Mama, who is doing up jams and running out of sugar and eating cane, not beet, for land's sake. So we each have a craft bag, him with 20 pounds of cane sugar and me with Necco wafers and sorghum drops. This is the town of Providence, the parish of East Carroll, the state of Louisiana. I'm not looking up at Papa, but along the way, a chestnut horse hitched to the post. He's fluttering his nostrils in my direction, making the sound of a whopping big cat purring like he knows me. The sun is halfway down from noon and it's hot, and on this particular day, the farthest I've been from Providence is the forests of oak and gum and pecan, west of town along the St. Louis and Mountain Railway track. And sometimes I've been with Papa on the Oxbow Lake,
also called Providence. The place full of cypress stumps that I always fancied to be steeple caps of lizards waving their eyes in the water one of these days. Rise and do what, I'm not sure. Sometimes I've climbed to the crown of the levee and stood to watch the Mississippi flowing wide and muddy from way up north and on past to New Orleans and into the Gulf. And already I'm starting to think about leaving. I turn my eyes from the river to the dark where God is working. You're not looking at him, God says. He's right. I return to Providence. We're still trotting the planks. I give my father an upward glance, past his shoulder, ready to find his eyes. But he seems intent up ahead. So I turn to the horse who knows me, and he stops his purring as I pass and gives me a snort. I think to address him, to ask him if he's God, standing there in this memory of 100 years ago, trying to keep me on track. But it's Papa who does that now, keeps me on track, by slowing abruptly, letting his free hand fall gently on my arm to hold me fully beside him, and I look ahead to see what he sees. A man and a boy are walking towards us, filling the navigable center of the sidewalk. They're still a little ways away, but I know why it's an issue. It's Louisiana, and it's 1908, and they are colored. A father and son, patched all over old ones. The boy is about my age, about my size, a milk jug for filling his hand. His eyes are fixed on the spot on the sidewalk where he will step next, and I look to his papa. He's got a brace of mink skins over his shoulder, and his eyes are just now moving from my father's to mine very briefly, and then back to papa. The colored man and his son keep on coming this way. Papa stops, and I stop. I look up at him and still can't see Papa's face, but I can imagine the upshooting crease that has just appeared on his brow between his eyes. That crease, when directed at me, always gets my full and fearful attention. And it is about to have the same effect on this man and his boy. Or so I assumed at the time. That's my Papa's severe expression that commands what happens next. The father abruptly slows, and his restraining hand falls to his son's shoulder gently. And even at the time when this is all going on, long ago, I am struck by how these two papas have done that same gentle thing to their sons. Just the same. His father's touch brings the colored boy's own eyes up and straight to mine. And I give him a look. He gives me a look. It's like we recognize what creatures we are and what our fathers need to negotiate, but also that there is nothing he and I could ever put into this world between us other than, well, I do recognize you, generally speaking. Sure enough, there you are. Only that. We all four of us are dead stopped now. My papa lets this be for one breath and another, and the colored papa is doing the same. And then mine says, "You're a trapper, I see." "And I am, boss," colored papa says. And that last word does not come out of him like he's being submissive. But not sneering either, more like familiar, casual. My father says, "You a new fellow in Providence? New to your eyes, maybe," he says. "I don't have a usual walk the street, but I am just looking to make a simple trade at the store for some basics." "That's it, then. You're new to the street." And with a serious, slow dip in his voice, he somehow makes it clear. He's not saying, "That's why you're new to my eyes." But rather, he's saying, "And to get through this situation without a big fuss, let's just assume you don't get realized that you and your boy are to yield the way to the whites in Providence, Louisiana." I can tell the colored father knows what Papa is really saying because he turns his face from us and looks down at his son, and he does this slow and keeping quiet, and you know he's sad for his son to be facing a situation and he's wondering how to teach him the rules of Providence, Louisiana in 1908, without losing his own dignity or putting a crack in his son's spirit. Choices that colored fathers might rightly have expected to cease being necessary 40-some years ago, before this particular colored father was even born. The boy is looking at me and seems oblivious. And I'm looking at him and probably seeming just as oblivious, which is probably what I am. At the time, I didn't know all this nuance was going on. I guess that's the thing God is letting me understand now in the retelling of it as I die. And God whispers in my ear, don't start getting all meta on me. Talking to me about talking to me. That just carries you farther away. You were taking most of this in at the time, even if you didn't understand. Just tell it as you see it right now and quit thinking about it. So the colored papa looks at his son for another few moments, even lifting his hand and putting it on the crown of his head. And he says, boy, slide off this here planking so these folks can find their way on by. I feel my father tense up just a little. How this man put it to his son is the reason. What was clear underneath those words, boundaries being set to the spirit of what they were doing, boundaries set by a colored man. That is evident to me now. So Papa is tensed up. He's got cane sugar, and I got a bag of penny candy. He's got his views, but for whatever else I'm picking up about my father, I see those views of his have their own boundaries. He doesn't make a fuss. He just stays tense while he waits for the colored man and the colored boy to slide on off the sidewalk, which they do. And they collect themselves out of the street. And they spectate as we move on by. My papa waits till we are out of earshot to break the silence between us. These ones, born since all the trouble, are incubator chickens. Raised without a mama to tell them who or where they are, especially these tractor boys, all they have to measure themselves by are trees and animals. And he says no more till we are approaching our house, and the road beneath our feet is dirt, and he stops us. He nods for me to hold my ground as he takes my bag of penny candy from me, and he steps away and puts it over on the verge of grass, and he sets his bag of sugar next to it. Then he takes up a water oak switch off the ground and heads for me, and I worry. But no, surely no. The thing in his hand is stiffer than a switch, a thing meant for a true beating. Beatings that have persuaded me in the past, persuaded me that I earned them because I came to accurately know when to expect them. And I know that today, so far, I have not earned a stiff whip beating. He stops before me. He says, now, boy, listen close. First, let me make something clear. Have you ever heard me speak of these breed of folks by using a slang word? No, sir, I have not. Well, it is also true, I clearly know what breed of folks you're referring to. Nor will you ever, nor have I allowed you to use slang words about them. This is true. Not an affirmation. They are colors, hypothesis. This is a simple fact. Like we are whites. All of us are made by God in these bodies, as Henry is made in his body, as Whimsy is made in hers, as a mountain lion is in his, and a deer buck in his, and a wolf. You understand? Yes, sir, I say. Henry being our dog, Whimsy our sometimes cat, feral but ours at her whim. I have heard all this before from my father, but this is his way. What I will, as a cub reporter in Chicago, someday learn to put at the bottom of stories, the background for previous stories, my father had a habit of putting in the lead, for which I wait. He lifts the stick. I struggle not to flinch. He turns his back to me. I am, as I suspected, off the hook. I can see he is stretching out his stick hand before him and touching it down. And then he moves his whole body to the right, starting to walk around me, drawing in the dirt as he goes. He returns to where he began and stands at my side. My papa and I are in the center of the circle. We got no choice in this life, he says. We are here to figure out one thing. Who are we? Where do we belong? There has to be a circle around us, because we ain't everywhere, and we ain't everybody. We all understand that deep down. Sometimes who's in that circle with you is clearly for the best. Sometimes it's regrettable. But you have to figure out where it must be drawn. And he stops talking. He tosses the stick outside the circle. We just stand there. I'm expected to ponder. I do ponder. But at the time, as a boy, I'm just calculating. Once that circle became what it was, the stick went out. So what about my bag of penny candy sitting over there in the grass? It ain't where I am. It ain't me. Have I lost it? And Papa asks, you understand? I feel him looking down at me. I do not look up. Whatever I've been picking up on through this whole thing, and whatever I've not, whatever I'm not understanding then, and whatever I will not fully understand, if at all, even a century hence, at that moment, I do recognize what I need to say, so I say it. Yes, sir, I understand. But I say it with my eyes averted from him, as if speaking to the circle in the dirt. I was a stupid boy. I may be a stupid old man. I have still not looked into my father's face. A realization that turns me to the dark. I wait for a rebuke. I almost say, am I reading your mind now? Almost, I do not. But God replies, nevertheless, there have been legions who believe they could do that. He pauses, makes a vocalized snicking sound, weary disapproval. Then, but at least in this case, you've told me twice already, I say, you read my mind, he says, oozing the words to make their sarcasm clear. I turn to my father. We stand at the edge of a clearing in the woods south of the lake. I am lowering my boyhood rifle from my shoulder, a Winchester 90, 22 caliber, for me to kill anything small. We have to pause. My father is beside me. I sense him there. But all I see of him out of the corner of my eye is the barrel of his own Winchester dipped down. He's model 1894 special, 32 caliber, to kill anything big. We have to kill any cover. A fine circle around the two of us, to my boy's mind. I will look into his eyes now, as I have indeed just killed something. Of course I will look. Their gaze in this moment is what I have killed for. I turn to him. He turns to me. I have my father's eyes, my mother says. Same dark blue. Gun barrel blue. Those eyes of his hold fast upon mine, and I find myself seeing something in them. I find myself believing it, a fierceness, but a tenderness as well. How do I see these contradictory things, things that are abstract to speak of, but are in fact minutely complex and sensual in the moment? Somehow I do. There is something in the shaping of them, or the casting outward of an internal light, or a latent weltering in their depths, things manifest to see but unnameable, that say, you are my son and you have done good. That say, you have encountered a small living thing, a flesh and bone and blood and fur or feather, a small thing, unable to do you or me any harm, and perhaps we will eat it, but that isn't really necessary. You have encountered this creature, and because you understand that you are stronger than it is, and that you have this weapon, you therefore have mortal dominion over it. And so you have shattered its body and taken away its life, which affirms who you lawfully are, and I am proud of you for that, my son. For that, I love you. Oh, fuck. I say this aloud, but not to my papa, who vanishes with those two words. Oh, fuck, you say? God's voice. I look toward him. Sorry, I say. diverted now to the matter of my profanity before the Creator. Curse words, a habit I acquired in my 70s. Oh, please, God says, who do you take me for? Profanity has nothing to do with words. Talk to me about your fucking heart. And I am standing on the levee. How old am I? I lift my hands to see, palms upward. They are young still. I can tell this from their size, from the straightness of the little finger of my left hand, which I will break at age 13, and it will set wrong and go a little crooked forever. But at the age I must be at this moment, I doubt I ever climbed this levee when my hands weren't tainted by grime, and yet these are clean, clean and white. As I see them from my deathbed a century later, no doubt. I drop them to my side. The river flows before me, familiar as my coonhound. I must have come here to cast my mind once more upon the current and glide away, and I realize someone is nearby. I turn. He's turning to me as well. The colored boy from the sidewalk. He rolls his shoulders, like the levee has no rules of race. I agree. I nod at him to say so. He hesitates. He nods in return. You got a name? I ask. Of course I do, he says. We let that be for a few moments. So do I, he said. He humphs. The boy has his daddy's spirit, I think. My own daddy would not like that. Papa would expect me to walk on away from this boy. Or maybe more likely expect me to tell him to go. But I say, can you see me here? Likewise, he says. I may have even gone hunting with Papa since me and this boy confronted each other with our fathers. Maybe even gone hunting and Papa gave me that look I will remember someday as I'm dying. Anyway, I think to say to this colored boy, you go hunting with your pa on you? The colored boy says, if you mean them skins, he trap it. I know you don't shoot a mink, I say. Hurt the pet. The boy nods. We fall silent. Then he says, you go trapping with your paw, do you? We just shoot things, I say. We don't speak for another few moments. The boy seems to be contemplating me and the situation. He reminds me of how his papa was in town, in the way of thinking carefully about what's next while standing at the edge of a circle drawn around white people. Then this boy says, Cyrus Dobbs. He has done some thinking that I didn't rightly expect, and it takes me a moment to catch up. His name, Cyrus Dobbs, I said. Cyrus been given me, but Dobbs was a name we got from the man owned my granddaddy. Not rightly our name, seems to me. Then what is? Don't have a clue. Sam, I say. That's my name, Sam Cunningham. Another silence, and I am thinking how no one owned my granddaddy. This boy Cyrus is probably thinking the same thing about me, which makes the silence drag on out, makes it hard and something to have anything else to say, seeing as how things are. Hard to tell how I'm picking up on what we've been both mulling over, same way I read my daddy's face in the woods, maybe, but I know, and I know Cyrus Dobbs knows. We both turn back to the river. Then I am on to my own thoughts. How my granddaddy was sure enough owned by somebody for a few years at least. The Confederate Army owned him body, brain, and soul. Eventually my mind comes back to the colored boy. I wonder if he is up here on the levee thinking like me on one other matter, getting away someday from Providence. So I turn to look at him once again, and his back is to me. He is already 50 yards or so on along the levee, heading off with a firm stride. The light on the levee fades now with that colored boy's leaving and vanishes, and I am in the dark again, though God doesn't pipe up right away. And I think more than a century later, they owned him for more than a few years. The Confederate Army owned my granddaddy from the war onward to his dying day. Do you remember my granddaddy, I ask, in the direction of God? No answer. I keep asking. When he stood or lay or stopped around before you, pissed as hell about the act of dying not being what he expected? Nothing. Do you remember him? Ezra, Theophilus, Cunningham. I remember them all, God says in a weary voice. Dare I ask, meaning heaven or hell for my granddaddy? No, God says. I am not surprised, I say, taking this to be an answer. Don't jump to any conclusions, God says. Has any of this so far gone the way you thought it would? Then a cloud, a roiling cloud, my mother's dark form within, with light pouring from a window, our kitchen in Providence, her back to me, steam, I suppose, from pots on the cast iron stove where she stands. I think of the sugar Papa and I sought, the jam she was making, but that's simply me trying to impose my own sense of order on these visions, a continuity, and I know that's a mistake. There seems to be so much steam, but she is large within his cloud. I am very small. This is another time, earlier, through my child's eyes. I watch her. I wait. She does not turn. She seems unaware of me. Her shoulders move at her work. Her hands are out of my sight before her. And the rushing now from behind me and past me, a vast dark form striding into the cloud. My father, his back eclipses hers, and his voice bellows. Can't make out the words, but I know their meaning. My mother has offended. And now it is night. I am alone in my room, and his voice again down the hall, and my mother's voice beneath, making a sound I sometimes hear from my own mouth. And I wonder, does he have a stiff wood branch in his hand? For her as well. I sit up in my bed. I think to rise, to go to see, at least to my doorway. To what end? He has rightful dominion over us both. Instead, I lie back. I shroud my head with the sheet. And I am in this bed another time, and my head is uncovered, and it is fiercely full of fire. And the muscles, the sinews, the very bones of my body are minced fine with pain. And my mother's hand is on my cheek, and then my forehead, and now her hand is upon my chest. And spreads a quickly expanding chill there. And the chill rises into my nose, menthol and eucalyptus. My head fills with the cold flame of Vicks, croup, and ammonia salve. There, she says, low, almost a whisper, leaning close, a secret. Good Dr. Vick goes across the ocean to Japan just for you, she says, for a special mint. Does it feel nice? Yes, Mama, I whisper in return. It will help you, she says. Am I going to die? I ask her. Her hand ceases its rubbing, but it stays where it has ceased, in the center of my chest. She is collecting herself. She is waiting until she can answer without weeping, without letting even a hint of tears taint her words. And finally she says, no, my darling, you will live to be an old, old man. Even as a child, I quailed at her hesitation. I knew she was afraid for me. Perhaps that hand in my chest was feeling my heart, was waiting for it to stop. What am I looking at through all this? Not her face? Vaguely the room, a low lamp she has placed on a dresser, lighting a patch of the far wall, a corner of the ceiling. I try now to turn my eyes to see hers, but I cannot move my eyes away from a meaningless patch of light. Still I try, in vain, until what I see is only darkness. Help me, I say, into the dark, assuming God is there. He does not answer. The darkness persists. I say, I want to see my mother's eyes. Nothing from God. Hey, I say, you are pushing me about Papa's eyes. And God says, you creatures there below never were very good at figuring out divine plans, even small ones. I feel myself dumbly staring into the dark. This you want for yourself, he says. Like he's telling me something I should already know. I'm still feeling dumb. He says, so? Okay, it's up to me. I close my eyes. I open them. I'm standing at the kitchen window. She's crouched on the ground beside a cast iron kettle. She's facing me, but her kerchief head is down. She's drying, plucking mallards. Her hands are moving quick but gentle. The feathers are going into the kettle. The dead birds, adorned as they were in life, are piled on one side of her. The plucked birds are on the other. The air around her is filling with woolly down, and she is focused on this work of her hands, her assigned role in our hunt. Lift your head, Mama. Look up, Mama. See me at the window. She does not. I wait. And the fog is thickening, and Mama fades within it. I still have not seen her eyes. It's been 100 years more, but it's my Mama. I can't have forgotten her. It's you holding her away from me, I say to God, even though the fog of feather down is still before me, too dense now even to make out her shape. I turn my face from the window to my mother's stove again in this little dream. Surely all of this is a dream. But no, it's just me dying, and it's Mama's stove, cold now, empty. She's in the yard plucking fucking ducks, and I can't see her. Of course not. Of course not. I was a little boy. I loved my mother, and she did her work, a mother's work. She pressed away my fever with her hand. She put her hand on my chest to save my life. She whispered to me when that's what I needed. But that was all temporary. Surely I had to become a man. I became a man. Surely that line was already drawn around me. I look back through the window. My father is standing there. My mother is gone. My father's eyes are upon me. But they are not fierce. It is my papa, waiting calmly for me to come join him, which is what I want. In this boy's body, standing in our kitchen a century ago, this is what I want. I want a papa. And this man is my papa, my only papa. I want to be his boy, want to be his big boy, want to be his son. I want to be loved by my papa, want to be a good boy in his eyes, want to be a fine young man. I want to be fit to be his son. I want to earn another day without a beating, because the beatings, when they come, are my own fault. That much I have learned, even if I haven't learned how to avoid them.
Thanks so much for joining us. Please don't forget that Bob's books are here at the bookstore from Midtown Reader. Please check those out. Also, if you could kindly bust your dishes back to the kitchen area, we would appreciate it. And also join us next week to hear from Kelly Jacobson and Daria Moisenko.